Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Rick Spezak. Welcome to Progressive News Network. And there we go. All we are saying is give peace a chance. We've got some great information for you tonight, some wonderful guests. Gene Economos and Dale Slongwhite are going to be talking about food safety, the work that they're doing to protect migrants, and, of course, the people who eat the food that the migrants picks. Then we've got Kip Rafferty, who's going to be talking to us about a wonderful event coming up this Tuesday. Emily Dillick from Progressive News Net will be talking to us about the research he's been doing recently on what's called ISIS or ISIL. And I'm sure you'll be very interested to hear what side we're on. And, of course, I know what side you're on. You're tuning in to Progressive News Network. And also our final guest of the evening will be Gwen Holden Berry, sage woman of great wisdom, progressive journalist, broadcaster, a woman you need to know about. But first, this update on the drilling in the West Coast. This, by the way, is from Fox News, oddly enough. Fox News from the drilling and the commissioners.
Is the Florida Department of Environmental Protection keeping oil drilling information under wraps? That's the concern of many Collier County neighbors and environmental experts after a letter was sent to county commissioners today about a controversial drilling site near the Corkscrew Swamp Sanctuary. 400 Corners' Katie Jones has details of that letter and why it has some residents outraged tonight.
Well, Emily, right now, Collier County commissioners are petitioning the unauthorized drilling activities from the Dan A. Hughes Oil Company at the Collier Hogan Well. And today, the DEP agreeing to address their concerns in order to move forward. And it's a move that's infuriating many residents.
It's an issue that's been drilled into many minds for more than a year now.
It's a very serious matter. It deserves the highest level of enforcement, which would be to revoke the permit.
Jennifer Hecker, Natural Resource Policy Director with the Conservancy of Southwest Florida, is outraged over the Dan A. Hughes Oil Company's unauthorized fracking-like practices at the Collier Hogan Well.
We're very concerned that these cancer-causing chemicals might have been injected along with the drilling fluids underground.
She says even more frustrating is the DEP's disregard of community concerns.
Still, we see no movement on addressing where did the wastewater go. It's contaminated in some cases with potentially very toxic substances.
Having similar worries, Collier County commissioners challenged the DEP's consent order with Hughes Oil. Today, the department agreed to many of their requests in hopes to move forward. The letter stating the DEP would share technical information, cleanup and groundwater monitoring plans, along with having the oil company provide a $1 million bond for potential costs. The only problem, Hecker and other neighbors say, is the information will be shared with the county, not the people.
The public is excluded, and really everything, what happened, that illegal fracking out at the Collier Hogan Well, is going to be wrapped around in secrecy. We're never going to find out what happened, and unless we find out what happened, we won't be able to stop it from happening again and again and again.
The DEP also saying the Dan A. Hughes Oil Company must hold at least 3 public informationals to answer community questions. But those we talk to say their concerns will only fall on deaf ears.
This is misleading to the public. The public meetings with Dan A. Hughes, those are not the meaningful public meetings that we were looking for.
The Conservancy and neighbors we talked to are asking commissioners to move forward with their petition and request an administrative hearing so everyone can have a voice in the process. I've reached out to all of them, but so far have only heard back from Commissioner Henning, who says right now it's too early to tell. Live in the studio, Katie Jones, Fox 4 in your corner.
And I want to remind you that the only reason DEP has moved off the dime whatsoever is because of citizens activists who've gone out there, who've raised the issue again and again and again. Finally, when the county commission, Collier County Commission, said, you know what, this does need to be further investigated, it turns out the DEP knew about drilling
illegal drilling back in January and never did a thing, never got water samples. Well, now, it's okay, though. When they were pressed with a lawsuit by Collier County Commission, they said, well, you know what, we'll have some secret meetings. Well, the county commission said, no, secret meetings aren't enough, and we need to have the water tested. Well, DEP, being those sleuths and scientists that they are, have put the water testing into the hands of the people that did the drilling. My goodness, you figured they'll be outing themselves? Well, film at 11 on that. We'll be staying in touch with the story, of course. And I'm sure you noticed that last week's guest was on that quote from Fox News over there in the West Coast, Jennifer Heckler. And also a regular guest, Dr. Karen Dwyer, was also on that. Now, the news. Net neutrality will require us to shine the light on Internet providers. A neutral Internet, one where the Internet service providers, ISPs, can't unfairly limit our access to parts of the net, create special fast lanes for some services, or otherwise handle data in a non-neutral way will require more than just rules that prohibit bad conduct. We're also going to need real transparency. Transparency is the crucial first step toward meaningful network neutrality. Without a detailed and substantive window into how providers are managing their networks, users will be unable to determine the reason why some web pages are slow to load. New services that hope to reach those users will have a harder time figuring out if there's some artificial barrier in place, and competitors won't know whether and how they can offer better options, assuming some kind of competitive environment actually exists. So now's the time. Get in touch with the FCC. Demand net neutrality. Or all those favorite sites that you get, all the alternate news sites, will be destined to be found only on the back roads and dirt roads and cobblestone roads of the slow side of the Internet. It's up to you. Do you want to be listening to just what ABC or NBC or CBS wants you to know, or CNN? Well, you better stand up for net neutrality. Now's the time. The FCC is listening, they say. Okay, open hearing, so sue me. A story about the West Coast drilling issue. West Coast of Florida, that is, by the way. And, of course, also all those explosive tests they want to do across the Everglades. Dr. Dwyer on the DEP response to the public meeting. Why wasn't the meeting open to the public? The DEP dropped by and had private meetings with the county commission. Herschel Vineyard, head of the DEP, is in Naples having private talks with each of the commissioners late into the night. The whole point of filing a petition was to have the government transparency and the full disclosure in a public forum rather than secret talks. The county lawyer told the commissioners that once they filed their petition, there could be no more discussion. Private talks could very well undermine the hearings and unduly influence what the commissioners finally settle on as an acceptable resolution. Sun for shame will not shine today. This is questions that Dr. Dwyer has sent to the county commission. Please confirm, is Herschel Vineyard in town talking to the commissioners? If so, when and where? Articles posted on state DEP head meets with Collier Commission chair, promises transparency in a secret meeting. Okay, let's see. He's promising transparency in a secret meeting. I know. I get it. Calling for the Truth and Justice Committee. Where's George Orwell when you really need him? Immunity from war crimes. You'll like this. We're looking forward, except when we're looking backward over our shoulder. Immunity from war crimes. Justice Department has filed a grant of immunity for war crimes against, hey, that blast from the past, George W. Bush, Richard Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, that's a Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell, Paul Wolfowitz, and Donald Rumsfeld. Remember the guy who was selling poison gas to Saddam as a private citizen is quite a deal. Okay, and the filing is for the immunity of war crimes was made with the U.S. District Court, Northern District of California, San Francisco Division. The filing is for procedural immunity in a case alleging that they plan and wage the Iraq war in violation of international law. Oh, my God, who could believe that, huh? The plaintiff in this case is Sundas Shakir Salem, an Iraqi single mother and refugee now living in Jordan. She filed a complaint in March 2013 in the San Francisco federal court alleging that the planning and waging of the war constituted a crime of aggression against Iraq, a legal theory that was used by the Nuremberg Tribunal to convict Nazi war criminals. Flash from the past. In her lawsuit, Saleh alleges that Richard Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz began planning the Iraq War in 1998 through their involvement with the Project for a New American Century. You've seen that, I'm sure, on the web. A Washington, D.C. not-for-profit that advocated for the military overthrow of, guess who? Saddam Hussein. And once they came to power, Saleh alleges that Cheney, Rumsfeld, and Wolfowitz convinced other Bush officials to invade Iraq by morning by using 9/11 as an excuse to mislead and scare the American public into supporting a war. What color is the terror today? That's what I want to know. Finally, she claims the United States failed to obtain United States approval prior to the invasion, rendering the invasion illegal and an act of impermissible aggression. The DOJ claims that in planning and waging the Iraq War, ex-President Bush and key members of his administration were acting within the legitimate scope of their employment and are thus immune from suit. Chief Counsel Indir Comer of Comer Law said, the Westfall Act certification, submitted pursuant to the Westfall Act of 1988, permits the Attorney General at his or her discretion to substitute the United States as the defendant and essentially grant absolute immunity to government employees for actions taken within the scope of their employment. Very far-seeing, weren't they? The good news is that while we were disappointed with the certification, we were prepared for it, said Comar. We do not see how a Westfall Act certification is appropriate, given that Ms. Saleh alleges that the conduct at issue began prior to these defendants even entering into office. I think the Nuremberg prosecutors, particularly American Chief Prosecutor Robert Jackson, would be surprised to learn that planning a war of aggression at a private nonprofit, misleading a fearful public, and foregoing proper legal authorization somehow constitute lawful employment duties for an American president and his or her cabinet. That's a case of Saleh versus Bush, and more to come on that one. Okay, you've heard of CAFTA, you've heard of NAFTA, you may even have heard of TIPS. But now there's a new one. It looks like they've caught their titsas in a leak. Another trade deal has leaked to WikiLeaks, and it looks as if it's one more effort to lock into law the interests of certain already huge corporations above the interests of government, their citizens, and potentially competing businesses. As with the leaks from the secret Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP, this leak shows that the largest corporations are working to bypass recent efforts by governments to rein them in by pushing through trade agreements, in quotes, that override their ability to write their own laws and regulations. This time, the leak is in the Financial Services Annex of the Trade in Services Agreement, TISA. It shows that TISA negotiations are an effort to not only undo the minimal regulation of Wall Street that occurred in the financial crash, but further deregulate financial markets worldwide. By the way, don't forget you can get more of this information at our site, averyvoice.com. And now let me welcome our first guest of the evening. Oops, and she's gone. I will continue. Despite failures in financial regulation evident during the 2007-2008 global financial crisis, calls for the improvement of relevant regulatory structures, proponents of TISA aim to further deregulate global financial services markets. TISA is a huge trade agreement that covers the services sector, which includes, I got your pencil and paper ready, audiovisual, finance, insurance, energy sector, transportation, logistics, express delivery, information technology services, and telecommunications. TISA currently has 50 countries represented. Hold on a second. Let me see if I can bring that guest in this time. Hello there. Welcome. I'm having a little trouble hearing you. Okay, well, that's for sure. And now they're gone. Okay, let's continue. TISA certainly currently has 50 countries participating in negotiations. Australia, Canada, Chile, Taiwan, Colombia, Costa Rica, the European Union, Hong Kong, Iceland, Israel, Japan, Liechtenstein, Mexico, New Zealand. Okay, let's see. Do we have our dear friend, Ms. Economos, or Ms. Dale Slongwhite? Let's see here. Hi there, Jean.
Yes, hi. How are
you?
Hi, Jean. It's good to talk
Welcome.
To you again.
Good to talk
Thank
to
you,
you as
Thank
well.
You.
So,
Thank you.
We have our summer season upon us, just celebrating solstice with my good friends this past weekend. Tell me, what's new in the world of, let's say, agricultural technology and human services?
Well, it's the summer months, and in Florida, this is the off season for farm workers and for a lot of agriculture in Florida. It's too hot to grow a lot of crops, so a lot of the farm workers that work in the crops in Florida tend to go north to Georgia, North Carolina, all the way up to New Jersey or Ohio, and they'll be back in August or September when the growing season starts again here in Florida. But there are lots of farm workers that still work in nurseries and in tropical fruits and things like that. So we still have things growing in Florida through the summer.
Good. Jean is with the Farm Workers Association. Jean, could you give us your full title, dear?
Sure. I'm the Pesticide Health and Safety Project Coordinator for the Farm Worker Association. And basically, I work on issues of pesticides and farm worker health, including doing trainings for farm workers. But we also work on issues of policy to try and get better protections for farm workers, to try and get some of the worst pesticides banned, and just to try and get help farm workers to get better health care related to pesticide exposure and things like that.
Well, we also have Dale with us. Dale, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And Dale is here besides the light she's going to shed on. She's also going to talk about her new book. Dale, could you give us the name of your book, please?
Yes, it is called Fed Up, The High Costs of Cheap Food.
Excellent. So, Jean, why don't you go ahead and continue a little bit, and then we'll let Dale talk about her book and what this really means to those of us who try to eat as wisely as possible.
Sure. I just would like to let people know that we're in a very historic time right now. The Environmental Protection Agency is responsible for protecting farm workers from pesticide exposure, and they issued rules 20 years ago that are called the Worker Protection Standard, and those rules have not been updated in 20 years. And for the first time now, the EPA has proposed stronger regulations to protect farm workers from pesticide exposure, and we have from now until August 18th for people from the public to make comments to the EPA supporting stronger protections for farm workers. We're already getting a lot of pushback from the pesticide companies, from the agricultural industry saying it's just too expensive, farmers don't have time to implement stronger regulations, nobody wants more regulations, so we need a big show of support from the public all across the United States to weigh in and tell EPA that they support stronger health and safety protections for farm workers. And I can send you the link to a couple of petitions and other information about how to submit comments.
Excellent. That was my next question, Jean. You're very wise. Go ahead, send me that when you get a chance today, and we'll get that up on the site. You know, it seems to me that we have a chance to really turn that tide. More and more people are aware of these things. More and more people, I think, are trying to eat healthy. And, you know, we hear about the slow food movement. We hear about urban farming. We hear about, you know, local farming. And more people are trying to pay attention to this. And it's so wonderful that, you know, you're able to help in this process. So I'm glad you'll be able to direct us to the right door at the EPA so these things can make the most impact. Are there any, you know, are there any new wrinkles, new things that they're trying, you know, make it look safer by actually doing something that all too often isn't so much safer?
Well, that's a good question. I'm glad you asked that. Actually, one thing that is good and that we support right now, farm workers only get are only required to get a training every 5 years on pesticide health and safety. And one of the things that the EPA is proposing is that the trainings be every year instead of every 5 years. That makes it more in line with OSHA standards.
Uh-huh.
One of the things that we don't like, however, is right now there's a requirement for what's called central posting, where a farm owner or a supervisor has to have a one location where there's information about when the pesticide was applied, what the name of the pesticide is, emergency information and things like that. And EPA is proposing getting rid of that, and we do not support that. So there's some very good things, and it's very, the whole document is over 300 pages long. It's very complex, but there's some very good things in there that EPA is proposing and some things in there that we feel are a step backwards. So it's really vitally important for EPA to hear from people all across the country to show that there's a broad sense of support for farm workers, because it's a David and Goliath fight. We're gonna be up against the crop lifes and the Monsantos of the world that are saying that we don't need more protections. So the Davids have to get their slingshots out and make their voices heard.
You know, I saw an interesting article in a science journal the other day, and a gentleman who was one of the editorial writers said, you know, he spent his college career and his post-master's work working on trying to improve certain stocks of crop. And he just couldn't seem to wrap his head around why there's so much resistance to, you know, what he called the whole GM issue. And I think what he was either consciously or maybe not so consciously glancing at, but not really hitting the mark, was that, you know, it's one thing to improve crop yield. It's a whole other thing to make crops pesticide tolerant so they can use more pesticide on them. There's obviously a lot of shades of gray involved here in the world of, you know, crop improvement and hybridization. And of course, restricting the sale of seeds and preventing people from being able to plant their own seeds is on a whole other level. So I think that this fellow did a real disservice to people who have serious concerns about that part of what we might call agricultural science. Let's turn over to Ms. Longwhite and have her tell us a little about the high cost of cheap food.
Yes, exactly. The high cost, the implication of that title is the cost to the people in the fields. You know, you're talking about eating the food or what's the effect on the consumers, but just imagine what it is like to be crawling down the fields. I can't believe how long these fields are, and people literally are either crawling on their hands and knees or bending over. And in the time period that I wrote the book, crop duster planes would come over and not ask them to leave the fields. There are people who have scars on their face or scars on their legs. In hot weather, they dressed with long sleeve shirts. I didn't even want to go outside today myself. It was so hot. I can't imagine all day long being in those fields. But, you know, it's amazing, Jeannie, when I hear the things that you have to say, that I thought that law you were talking about, that they would have to put the regulations in more than one place than so that people could see them more. What were the effects of some of the pesticides they were working in, and yet you're saying they want to take that away. That's pretty unbelievable.
And what's shocking to me is that there weren't even any regulations until 1992. And that's why I think Dale's book is so important, because the book is based on interviews with farm workers who were working in the fields prior to there being these regulations that the EPA enacted. And they were passed in 92, but they didn't get enacted until 1995. So a lot of the African-American farm workers were exposed at a time when some of the most dangerous chemicals were being used, and also before there were regulations to protect them. So it is very, the more you learn about it, the more disturbing it is, and the more impactful I think the book is.
The way that the system works, and I don't think that, you know, I'm not trying to say anything against it, is it takes a lot of research in order to for something to go on the market or to come off the market. And so people in labs know, you know, have an idea of what is harming people, but it will take years before laws can be passed and enacted. DDT, chlordane, toxaphene. Actually, dieldrin, which was also used in the field, has now been found in whales currently. I attended some meetings that were – so these things, these toxins that were used years ago and are now banned, the results of them are still in the environment.
You know, I was wondering – go ahead, Jean.
Well, I was just going to say, related to the labs, a lot of times the labs do what's in the corporate best interest, too. So sometimes the science – the science is based on,
let's say, the
handmaiden
of
what's
commerce.
The bottom line. Right, exactly.
Yeah, who sponsors the research is a big question.
Exactly.
We have a situation over on the West Coast where there's been some drilling, and the state knew about it back in January and February and didn't even bother mention to the public, knowing full well there was a huge public outcry since April. And now they're going to let the drilling company provide the water testing results. Isn't that just peachy keen? Obviously, they're going to be, you know, very rigorous to find themselves at fault, don't you think? And
fox guarding the hen house.
Yeah, please. Get that fox in here and have him count the chickens for us, would you? I was wondering, are you getting any, you know, obviously the state has some interest as well as the National Environmental Department. Is there any interest, is there any attention from DEP on some of these issues?
Well, in Florida, the agency that works with farm workers is actually the Department of Agriculture. And I will say that there's some people that we have a much better relationship with the State Department of Agriculture than we've had in years. And I think there's some really good people there that really do want to see better protections for farm workers. But both the EPA and the state agriculture departments are the state agencies that are charged with enforcement and compliance. They're between a hot rock and a hard place because on the one hand, they have farm worker advocates pulling them in one direction, and then they have the big guys, the farm bureaus and the crop life, et cetera, pulling them in the other direction. And, you know, they're supposed to be fair and balanced. We do find some very good people in both of those, the EPA and the Department of Agriculture, and then you find people that really are kind of beholden to the other side. So, you know, it's they are agencies. There's a lot of politics that plays in there, so it's a big juggling act that they have to do to try and balance both interests.
Of course, you know, none of this is to say, and you know, I think some people feel that individuals with environmental issues concern or food safety concern are, you know, mad to regulate, mad to constrict the free market, so-called. I was speaking to some conservatives the other day, and, you know, they threw that sort of thing at me, and I said, you know, let me ask you a question. You know, you can spout your small government deregulation nonsense as much as you want. I said, but let me ask you a simple question. Do you want safe food? Do you want to be able to trust the pills that you're prescribing and handing to your children? Do you want to drink water that's safe? Because if you do, then let's face it, we need to have some regulation to make sure that somebody in a rush to make a fast buck
doesn't decide that this white powder looks a lot like that white powder, and what the hell, why don't we use that? It seems to me a very simple thing to understand. The purpose of regulation is to make food safer. Now, let's talk for a second about the farm workers. Now you mentioned that the regulations weren't in place till 94, and I would imagine that many of these people have worked for a long time without that regulation, without the knowledge, and thank goodness you've been able to train people for a while. But I'd be willing to bet that the health care available to the folks in the migrant community is not tremendous.
Go ahead, Jenny. You can answer that. All right. I'll start, Jenny, then you can jump in. Yeah, actually, that's true. There are some clinics, but it's mainly perhaps for pregnant women, or it is just for general care. What has happened is that these individuals have illnesses that need specialized care. You're talking about people who have had a kidney transplant, or people that are on dialysis for a long time, or have lupus and need all kinds of specialists for that. So it's very difficult. The other problem has to do with transportation. Many of them do not have cars, and so to get to where they need to go, transportation is a problem. Or if pills, if prescriptions are written for them, they don't have the money in order to buy the prescriptions. So yes, it is. It's a very big problem.
And Dale doesn't even know this, but Geraldine is in the hospital. I went to visit her yesterday. For the conservatives that talk about regulation, I just want to say that the results of not having regulation impact costs on health care, because farm workers who have chronic health problems, who have acute health problems from exposure to pesticides, they're going to be sick. And whether they have Medicare or Medicaid or disability or whether they have no insurance at all, they're going to be impacting health care costs, because just like Geraldine, who's in the hospital now, and others who have chronic illnesses and are having to go to the doctors, that has to get paid, and that raises our medical costs. And you can tell your conservative friends that if he wants to go out and pick oranges or pick tomatoes, then that's fine. He can go ahead and do that. But right now it's farm workers that are doing it for very low wages and putting their health on the line. And I know that people are concerned about eating healthy and sustainable agriculture, but people also need to realize that farm workers are harvesting the majority of the food that we eat, and yet they're still the invisible ones. Thank heavens for Dale's book that's helping to open that door and make them more visible. But any person that eats and that doesn't grow their own food is inextricably connected to farm workers if they didn't grow that food themselves, and whether they're aware of it or not. So we all owe a debt to farm workers as long as we're eating food that we didn't grow ourselves. And farm workers are putting their health at risk just so that we can have food to eat.
You know, it seems to me that people are very short-sighted sometimes when they neglect to realize that something quote, you know, seemingly onerous as regulations that make pesticides safer or limit the application to safer chemicals, you know, do they forget that this is the food that lands on their plate? Whether it comes in a cellophane wrapper or it comes at the local fruit stand, this is the food that is grown for our consumption. And, you know, when you think about the amount of chemistry used on these crops and the potential residues that are on there, now that's one thing. But these people that are on the front line, they're getting the serious dose. And I just think it's so wonderful that you've been able to give them some help and give them some training to reduce as much as you can some of the impact.
One of my purposes in writing this book was to take away the label farm worker. Once we put a label on somebody, we sort of think that's the way they should be treated. So in this book, they're people. They're individuals, which sounds pretty basic, but I've taken away that label of farm worker, and we hear the stories from their point of view. What I don't understand is that why so much money is spent on the lake or on studies or, you know, $1 million went into a study to reveal why the birds died in 1998, and they found out from ingesting DDT, toxifying dialdrin. In 85, a $2.2 million feasibility study about what are we going to do to clean up the lake, and $100 million to purchase and close the farms and stop the pollution. All of these millions of dollars that that go into things other than human beings, it's something that that still baffles me and I don't understand.
I was working with an environmental engineering firm for a while, and I was very happy to be participating in something called the Underground Tank Survey. And we were studying where underground tanks had been, what toxins had been in them, where the potential plumes were. And I turned to one of the environmental engineers one day and I said, you know, this is fantastic. You know, we're doing research back to the 20s and 30s, the early settlements of the industrial America here on the coast. This is wonderful. Now, what's the next step? And he looked at me and he said, well, there is no next step. The money is all eaten up by the survey. I said, you mean all this research that we're doing is going to go sit in a folder someplace? He said, yep, that's right. And that's more glimpse I got of how the system works to minimize the attention given to such crucial matters.
Well, speaking of research, again, going back to people that are concerned about too much regulation, there have been studies that have shown that newborn babies today, not 10 years ago, not a generation ago, but newborn babies today have as much as over 200 chemicals are found in the umbilical cord blood of newborn babies today, and one of those chemicals includes DDT. So whether you're conservative or you're Republican or Democrat or conservative or liberal, you probably have DDT in your body. And that's from legacy chemicals like DDT and dieldrin and toxaphene. And so it's because we didn't have regulation and these chemicals were allowed to be used and that they are so pervasive in the environment that just about everybody in the United States probably has some level of DDT in their body. And that's what happens when you don't have regulation.
Jeannie, DDT was banned in 1975. So you're telling us that 38 years ago, I mean, babies born 38 years after DDT was banned, this is found in their umbilical cord blood.
Correct.
I did hear you correctly.
It's because it's a persistent organic pollutant, which means it doesn't go away. It's the POPs, POPs, are under the Stockholm Convention, and they are a list of chemicals that were supposed to be banned, and DDT was banned in the early 70s, and yet it's persistent in the environment. And, yes, this is today. Today there's DDT in almost every person in the United States. It goes up the food chain. It stays in your fatty tissue. And so newborn babies today that were born that had nothing to do with farm work or farming have traces of DDT in the umbilical cord. So what does that mean about farm workers that were exposed over decades, over generations, that were exposed daily to DDT and in much closer contact, not just from eating, not just from their mother? Women in the Arctic, indigenous women in the Arctic, have high levels of pesticides and other things in their breast milk. And they're thousands and thousands of miles away from any sources of these kinds of pollutants. And yet they're in the fish because they're pervasive in the environment and they eat high levels of fish. So we have some very serious problems, and we need a lot more regulation and not a lot less. We're exposing ourselves every day to a toxic soup of chemicals, whether it's pesticides or otherwise. And unfortunately, it's a terrible way to frame it, but farm workers are the canary in the coal mine, and we're not paying attention to that canary.
Amazing. It's just amazing. You know, I was wondering,
Is there survey material out there right now that weighs the chemicals used in varying crops so that we could say that eating this currently industrialized grown crop is particularly worse than eating another particularly industrially farmed crop? So, for example, let's say that the chemicals used treating potatoes are at one level of toxicity you should be aware of, but the chemicals used, say, growing strawberries are much worse or persistent. Is there analysis like that out there, Jean?
Yes, you can go. You can Google the clean the clean 15 or the terrible 20, the terrible 20 or the clean 15. And actually, Pesticide Action Network just came out with the new one, the Toxic 20. So if you go to Pesticide Action Network website and Google or search for the Toxic 20, they'll tell you the crops with the highest levels of pesticides. And it's funny you should say that, because when I do Lake Apopka toxic tours, one of the things I ask is how many people like strawberries. And, of course, strawberries is one of, people's favorite fruit. And I tell people... I make people very unhappy, but I tell them that I stopped eating strawberries about 15 years ago when I learned that Canada will not allow import of U.S. strawberries into Canada because our pesticides exceed Canada's pesticide levels. So strawberries are very high in pesticides, so are potatoes, any starchy food, and so are apples and peaches. But you can Google that. I'm sorry, it's the Dirty Dozen or the Clean 15.
Jean, yeah. That brings me to another question that I have for you. You mentioned that some of our strawberries cannot be exported into Canada. What about other foods and our export and import? What regulations from other countries? Much of our food is imported from other countries. What are the regulations there?
Right, that's a really good question. We have regulations for crops grown in this country, but it's still legal to use DDT in Mexico and other places. So, and there's no regulations about levels of pesticides on foods that are imported into the United States from other countries. So you do need to be careful of that when you're buying produce from other countries.
Gosh, that's an oversight.
Right, exactly. There is the Food Quality Protection Act where they're supposed to test residues of pesticides, but that doesn't test systemic pesticides. So there's two kinds of ways you can get pesticides from your food, and one is as a residue on top of the food, but recent scientific studies over the past several years have shown systemic pesticides, which means that plants are taking it up through their roots. So it's actually in the food itself, not just the residue on top of the fruit or vegetable.
Yeah, I can imagine that's pretty much the most serious problem rather than surface, because most people scrub the exterior of their vegetables to an extent. Some of them are less amenable to it, strawberries, for example, but obviously repeated applications, it's going to get inside the whole plant. It's not going to be just on the surface.
And if I could bring that back around to the farm workers again, one of our concerns is that farm workers are exposed occupationally to pesticides on a daily basis. And even today, even though DDT is banned, there's a whole new classes of pesticides, pyrethroids, neonicotinoids, organophosphates, carbamates. So there's still a whole slew of pesticides that farm workers are exposed to. So we feel that compromises their immune system. And then when they eat, if they're eating food that also has pesticides on it, then they're getting, a double dose, or probably even more than a double dose because of their close exposure in the fields. So they're getting it from more than one source, whereas the rest of us might be getting it just from one source.
Yeah, and don't forget the wind drift problem, too.
Sure.
Many of the farm workers live close to the farms, and so the pesticides will be blown over to where they live, or they will bring the individuals that I interviewed, they would bring home canisters or barrels or things where the pesticides had been housed, and they would use them. So there's a lot of different ways that they are exposed.
I'm glad you mentioned drift, because that's another thing that the EPA is looking at right now. There's also a public comment period on pesticide drift, and I can try and find that link for you also. People can also send in comments related to pesticide drift. So if you live in a rural agricultural area, now is your time to tell the EPA that there should be buffer zones around agricultural areas. So there's two good opportunities to make comments to EPA and have your voice heard.
When my family was young, I had my wife and I had three children out in our yard all the time, and we lived in an agricultural zone down in the Homestead area, and there was a local crop sprayer who randomly from time to time would just dump residues anywhere in the neighborhood, and one time he dumped it right on the trailer park where children were playing outside, and I called the county Department of Environmental Research, and they said, well, you know, DERM, Department of Environmental Resource Management, and they said, well, you know, if you'd like, we'll write a strongly worded letter to them. And I said, I don't think a strongly worded letter will really do it. And they said, no, you're probably right. He's done this before. And I said, well, when do you get to the real enforcement? They said, well, you know, we could fine him $100. I said, well, I think you should. If that's all you can do, if that's your big guns, please get out your big guns. This is unconscionable dumping it on them. And again, where you've got people who are exposed to this, you know, crawling between the plants, crawling in among the plants, and with especially with nervous system pesticides, I would think that there's got to be to our great horror, there's got to be neurological damage being done, not just to the current field crop people, but people, you know, their descendants.
Oh, there's
absolutely
no doubt about that. You go ahead, Jeannie.
And organophosphates are one of the most commonly used pesticides now, and organophosphates do affect, they work by affecting the nervous system of the insects that they're supposed to kill. And so if they're affecting the nervous system of the insects, what are they doing to the humans that are exposed to them also? I would like to encourage anybody that's listening, one thing that you can do is there's very little reporting of pesticide-related illness in the state. And it's very difficult. It's very complicated to get. It's a long process, and there's bureaucracy involved. If anybody listening lives in a rural area and they feel, or in a residential area, if they feel like they've been drifted upon, call poison control. Call the poison control hotline. They have to document it. Tell them it's a pesticide, a suspected pesticide exposure incident. They have to document it, and the Florida Department of Health has to record it. And we need lots more records of pesticide-related illness, because right now the state thinks that there's no problem because nobody's reporting anything. Exactly.
And who knew? Who knew you could report it and where to report it?
Well, you have to report it as symptoms that you're having. You can't really, they don't take reports of a plane flying overhead. You have to report symptoms. So if you're having a headache or nausea or blurry vision or irritated eyes, and you think it might be from that plane that flew overhead or that was dusting the crops right next to your house, then you should call and say, oh, by the way, you know, I'm having these eye problems, and they just sprayed over there. And the poison control has to document it. Now, they don't do any enforcement, but at least they have to document it, and it gets on the record.
Excellent.
And so we would hope that in the future, those records will be used for something. We can hope.
Right. Yes. Yes.
Well, you know, without the good work that you're doing, there certainly would be a lot less good done. Ms. Slongwhite, could you tell us how we can get your book?
Certainly, you can get it through Amazon is the easiest way. Some Barnes and Nobles have it in stock, but if you could order it from a bookstore if they don't have it in stock, or order it on Amazon, either way.
And the name again is?
I'd like to say, oh, I'm sorry.
It's called Fed Up, The High Costs of Cheap Food.
Fed up the high cost of cheap food. Excellent.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Jeannie, you were going to say.
Well, I just want to say I think Dale's book is so vitally important. I think it's important for anybody that cares about food, anybody that cares about social justice, anybody that cares about the environment and wants to know more about Lake Apopka. But I also think it has an extremely important historical value, because I have not seen anything in museums, in historical records or documents that really talk about the history of African-American farm workers in Florida. And I think that that's one message we really want to get out there to universities, to colleges, to high schools, to museums, because this is a voice that's not been heard before. You have heard, I've seen exhibits about the African-American turpentine workers. I've seen exhibits about Hispanic farm workers. But this is a history that has not been captured, as far as I am aware, anyplace else. Patrick Smith wrote a book about white farm workers in Florida many years ago, but I have not seen any other place where the actual voices and histories of African-American farm workers has been recorded. So I think it plays a vital role in our state's history.
Well, it sounds like we should be requesting this at our libraries, too.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Jeannie, for that. I wanted to say that in researching this book, I went to a program titled 5,000 Years of History of Lake Apopka, and I had already interviewed all of these African Americans who had migrated to the area, you know, 100 years ago, their ancestors did. And African Americans did not get mentioned in a program entitled 5,000 Years of History of Lake Apopka.
James Baldwin strikes again.
Right, exactly. The invisible man. Mm-hmm. the invisible farm workers.
I can't thank you enough. Gene, could you tell us how people can get in touch with you and get in touch with your work and try to help you somehow?
Sure. The phone number here at the office is 407-886-5151, and they can ask for me, Jeannie Economos, or they can go to our website, which is www.floridafarmworkers.org.
Fantastic. And Ms. Longwhite, they can get your Fed Up High Cost of Cheap Food at their Barnes & Noble, through Amazon, and of course, we want to get them to request it at their library so they can get this book out there for wide distribution. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you both so much.
Thank you very much for having us.
Okay.
We're very grateful. Thank you very much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you again for the great work that you do. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Okay, and now, ladies and gentlemen, I want to bring you this presentation from Kit Rafferty, who will be talking about an event this Tuesday.
Hello, this is Kit.
Hello, Kit. This is Rick Spezak, Progressive News Network. How are you today?
Fine, thanks. How are you?
Very good. Very good. Kit, I know you've got a very interesting event coming up. So why don't you go ahead and tell us about Working Women Vote Town Hall Meeting.
I'd be more than happy to. I don't know whether your listeners know, but on June the 23rd, there's a White House Summit on Working Women and Families that's being hosted by President Obama. There's going to be workers there and lots of community and labor leaders to listen to issues that particularly low-wage working women have. I mean, there are a multitude of issues. So we're following up on that to do something local. And really, basically, we're talking, it's good, because it's going to get a lot of publicity, we hope. You know, we're really working with women who are low-wage workers. Some of them, many of them work for minimum wage, live paycheck to paycheck. Many of them work for Walmart. They have part-time schedules with minimum wage and no benefits. Many of them are juggling work and family. Many of them are caregivers to an older generation and to their children, and work two or three jobs. Many of them obviously need a raise, and they need, one of the major things that people really need in this state are earned paid sick days. About anywhere between 50, 40 to 50% of working people get absolutely no earned sick time. And if they do take a day off, many of them are threatened with loss of their jobs. And this is particularly important in a service economy that we have in Florida.
Well, it looks like you've got a great number of organizations that are participating.
Yes.
Can you talk about some of your partners?
We have a coalition of labor and union. We have the A. Philip Randolph Institute, the National Coalition of Black Women, the NAACP, and one of the panelists is the president of the Miami-Dade NAACP. We have South Florida Interfaith Worker Justice, FEIU. The League of Women Voters is there to do voter registration, and they're also there to talk about a study they did on the failure of charter schools in this state. And, of course, we have SEIU and AFSCME joining us, Catalyst Miami, and the Restaurant Opportunity Center of Miami, National Council of La Raza and Planned Parenthood, and One Miami, which is a part of SEIU. They're really community organizers. So, yes, we have a great group of people. We worked with these same people on the Affordable Care Act, and this is sort of a continuation of that because we're going to be doing a lot of discussions about the Medicaid expansion. And that's the money that Rick Scott did not take to expand Medicaid in this state. And many of these low-wage working women are ineligible for Medicaid because they work. But they also are ineligible to sign up for Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act, because they don't make enough money. So they have access to no health care whatsoever.
Well, it's nice to see that there's at least an increasing awareness about the difficult struggle of working on a minimum wage salary. And we've seen some small progress here and there to improve that. Is it your hope that we'll be seeing maybe further progress in some Florida employers, that they may be seeing their way to finally scraping a few pennies off the executive and giving them to the workers who actually earn the money?
I'd like to be an optimist on that, and I'd like to believe that people do the right thing. But I know a senator in a House of, in Cynthia Stafford in the House of Representatives at the state level tried to pass a minimum wage law, raising the wage here or statewide to $10.10 an hour. It didn't even get a committee hearing.
That's a
shame. So, it's just that the politics of this are difficult in a state as gerrymandered as Florida is, and with a legislature that doesn't care about working families. Not this past legislative session, but the legislative session before that, they passed a preemption bill that said no local political jurisdiction could pass any ordinance to provide earned sick time to working people. So we can't do it in the state right now legislatively, locally.
Well, lastly, legislative session, they passed a bill with a tax break for people who own their own planes. Maybe some of the minimum wage workers can take advantage of that tax break.
Yeah, absolutely they could take advantage of that tax break.
You've got some great speakers, I see. Commissioner Audrey Edmondson, Adora Obi-Nueze, NAACP president, and Cynthia Stafford from the Florida State Representative.
Right. She was the House sponsor of the raising the minimum wage bill.
Well, it's so great to see you pulling this kind of meeting together. And let's see, it's at the Caleb Center on 22nd Avenue and 54th Street, right?
Right, that's exactly where it is, Building A, Room 110. And it's, we're going to be serious, but we're also going to have some fun. We have a DJ coming, and we have, light refreshments and some very interesting people speaking about, some workers speaking about, for example, we have a worker coming from the Transport Workers 291 who's going to talk about why, because she has a union contract, she gets paid the same for the same job as a man. But without a union contract, that's often not possible. You know, you have to keep your pay secret, et cetera. So equal pay for equal work, that's obviously part of her union contract. If she's a bus driver, she makes as much as a bus driver who's a man. So we're going to have that. We're going to have one of the minimum wage workers from a nursing home down here. They take care of our most vulnerable citizens, people that can't live at home anymore and need constant care. And these people work for next to nothing. They can't live on the wage they make. And that's shameful in our society because these are people that take care of our most vulnerable.
Well, you're absolutely right. If people want more information about this event, I know you have a Facebook page. Where would you say the best place to go to get more information about the event?
You can call Deborah Guillon at 305-213-3165 or me, Kit, at 305-987-5251.
Well, I want to wish you every success, Kit. You're doing a great job, and this is going to be a really super event. Maybe you can give us a holler after the event and tell us some of the good things that came from it. Thanks so much for joining us.
I'd be happy to. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye, Kit.
That was Kit Rafferty talking about an event this coming Tuesday, South Florida Voices for Working Families. And now Ms. Emily Dillick, who's going to be talking about ISIS and ISIL, and who's the puppet master on this project. And this is a report of hers, first published in progressivepress.net. Make sure you check it out, progressivepress.net. And here she is, Ms. Emily Dillick. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Ms. Emily Dillick, publisher of progressivepress.net. And she's going to talk to us about some research she's recently been doing on what I'm going to call the real story between, among the various nations of the Middle East. Now, Emily, if one was to think about the popular narrative is that, oh, the Arab Spring has been part of the evolving search for democracy among the nations of the Mideast, from Pakistan to the coast of the Mediterranean. And if one were to look just a little deeper, one could easily say that the bull in a china shop of American policy has stirred up not just something called the Arab Spring that many think is a very positive thing, but has really been part of a move to unleash incredibly explosive and destructive changes among the patchwork quilt that was the results of post-World War I. We hear in America that now that A, the Iraq War was won, and B, the Afghanistan War is won. And yet there seems to be things still falling apart again in Iraq. And there are those here who would urge us to immediately rush back to Iraq, if not with troops, certainly at least with bombs. What can you tell us about this evolving situation? I know you have a lot of information and contacts because you come from part of that region. Emily, what the heck's going on? What have you learned from your research?
Well, the first thing is I wanted to tell your listeners that why it's my job as a journalist, of course, to question the official narrative. But I became more suspicious after the disaster of Iraq invasion because there were no WMDs and, you know, there were no sarin gas there. And everything was a lie. Everything was based on a lie. And after that, I totally lost faith in official narrative. And whenever I hear something from the U.S. government now, and this is not only the U.S. government, by the way, the Turkish government, Spanish government, now, you know, I live in Spain, and I just had this sense that whenever I hear coming from a government, I need to question it. And when I found out about this group, we knew about them long, long time ago, ISIS or ISIS, however you would like to pronounce it,
sure,
that moved into Iraq on June 11th, and they start taking over this big, second largest city, Mosul, of Iraq. They took over with such an ease, and speed that I knew there was something wrong with it. I knew that it was just not possible for this 3,000-4,000 of people just walking through in a country and then taking over a major city. So I started, based on my own research and our own publishings from last year, we've been following, of course, what has been happening in Syria since the civil war started 3 years ago. But and I knew that there were a lot of jihadist groups that were growing there, different factions. And my first question, initial question was, I know that the United States and the Western countries have a lot of satellites and a lot of monitoring and surveillance there, including the drones. You know, everybody knows about drones. So my first question was that, how did they not see them? How did they not see this group of people using the main roads? I mean, they didn't come through the mountains. They came with their cars. They have these brand new Toyota trucks, white. They're not even like camouflaged. They're white, shiny, with their full gear, well-armed, well-trained, just taking the main road and moving into Iraq from Syria and Turkey. And I said to myself, how could the U.S. government surveillance didn't catch that, right? So that was like my first question that kind of started my thinking about it. And then when I did more research on them, who this group is, and I knew that in Syria, the opposition groups included, many of them were very extremist jihadists. And we were providing, United States government was providing arms, funding, and training to these people just because we want a regime change there. And, of course, the narrative in the media is the big bad dictator, Assad. Again, it's the same narrative, you know, the bad dictator. I am not saying Assad is a good guy, by the way.
Right,
so
right.
Your readers understand that I have no sides in this. I am not supporting Assad. I am a journalist. I'm just bringing information in. Assad has his own problems, apparently. You know, they've been governing Syria for long years, so people were not happy there. And but of course, there were different ways of for the Syrian people to deal with that instead of us and the Western countries getting involved. I think we need to start the whole story from NATO. What was the NATO originally established for, and what is NATO's role in all this? And who are the Gulf Cooperation Council, GCC countries? So when you see a group like this suddenly being extremely powerful and with advanced machinery, weapons, and like I said before, brand new trucks, you need to start questioning where this money is coming from, where is their funding coming from. I know originally United States, we fund them directly because in order for United States government to provide any funding to an outside group, it needs to go through Congress. So we had this approval and all this. And so that was all over the news if anyone was following that. We did provide money initially to opposition groups in Syria. And that was a few years back when the civil war started, and my research from the local news in Turkey and the region was telling me that these groups, most of them, were jihadists. So I was publishing, I was providing information to Americans and anyone that reads English that these people are kind of dangerous, extreme jihadists. So why are we supporting them? So it is. I think sometimes the United States government chooses to work with these extremist groups in order to advance its, United States interests in the region, and I can't understand the rationale behind that. But we also need to understand they're extremely dangerous, and they can always turn on us. So just like there is an expression, when you lay down with dogs, you wake up with fleas. You know, we need to really be careful when we're meddling in other countries' affairs. I do understand maybe the original or official initial intention was to really support the Syrian people against their bad government. I do understand that. But we also need to understand where, who are these people, what's going on actually in the Middle East.
Emily, so let me pick apart a couple issues and ask mm-hmm. you to give me your insight on them. Now,
okay.
we know there's many driving principles, which I think to an extent can underscore and maybe even explain some of the odd behavior of the U.S. vis-a-vis the Middle East. For example, now, obviously, we need to be supportive of our allies, so-called the Saudis. We know that our, again, allies, and I use that in quotes, because clearly we have a very narrow range of common interests, and the Saudi monarchy, the Saudi oppression of human rights is clearly nothing to do with the American goals of individual freedom and individual rights. That's clear. But clearly there are economic interests that align us politically with the Saudis in many areas. It's also widely known that Saudi tends to ship off its revolutionaries to go do damage to somebody else's country. We know that. We mm-hmm. know that they have funded, as have we, the Taliban. They funded mm-hmm. radicals in Pakistan. They funded mm-hmm. radicals in Syria. And let's just take, for example, the nonsense that has been brought to bear and the suffering that's been caused to the Iraqis. We were at one time both helping the Iraqis and the Iranians while they fought each other. We have
yes.
armed the Iraqis, and then
correct.
We've also attacked them for having the arms that we sold them. We have worked closely with Mr. Assad when he was one of our torturers.
Correct.
And also we worked closely with the Egyptian government when they worked with us as part of our outsourcing of torture. And yet now we're attacking Assad, and we are seemingly on both sides of the Iraq conflict. Seemingly, we were in large part providing funding via Turkey to some of these ultra-radicals in Syria who are now part of the war on Iraq. Clearly, this is a really convoluted mess where we seem to be on four or five different sides, all of which are fighting each other at the expense of the people who probably just want to live and be left alone.
Yes, yes. Unfortunately, the people of each country, I mean, they don't want war. And this sectarian idea of, you know, sectarian violence everybody's talking about, even the leftist, you know, left side of the news media, talking about centuries of sectarian violence, it's really a ruse. You know, it's not. People lived in relatively in peace in the region, and the Ottomans were there. You know, there were a few uprisings, but other than that, the major bloodshed started really after the oil was discovered in the Middle East, and that's sad. But I wanted to give your readers an understanding of how this, in general, how it works.
Please do.
First of all, the Gulf Cooperation Council, GCC, which is a regional intergovernmental political and economic union. It's kind of like European Union, but more on an economic base. And that union includes most of the Islamic monarchies of Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Kuwait, Oman, and Qatar. So originally money comes, funding comes from these people to these groups when Saudi Arabia, especially Saudi Arabia, wants more domination on the region, especially on the routes of oil, because, you know, they produce oil and they just want to make sure they control the oil routes, the way it's produced and the way it's traded, on top of it, the pricing of it. So Saudis definitely want major control in Middle East. And on top of it, the United States want it because we need the oil. So what happens when they decide a regime change, just like what happened in Syria, Saudis and Bahrain and Qatar, especially Qatar, Saudis and Kuwait, started funding these groups, opposition groups. So money went to them. And how did money go to them? Money went to them through Turkey and Jordan and other countries in the region that are supporting this initiative and this objective. One example a lot of people don't understand the difference between Sunnis and Shiites and Wahhabis. This latest group that went into Iraq right now that everybody's talking, they're so brutal and horrible, they're Wahhabis, which are Sunnis are. Sunnis are Wahhabis also. So Wahhabis are the kind of like the orthodoxy of Islam. They're the most extreme part of, you know, Islam, Muslim religion. They are funded by GCC, Gulf Cooperation Council, and who trains them? Okay, and where they're trained. They're trained in camps in Turkey close to the border. Some of them are just simple camps, and some of them are also the refugee camps where the Syrians were running away, the civilians were running away from the civil war, and they went into Turkey, and the Turkish government set up these refugee camps for them. So some of the training for these jihadis were done in those, I'm not sure if it's still going on, but it was done in those camps. And there are also some camps in Jordan. So this is all explained in my latest article where I got the information, and then, you know, your readers can read it and get more information about that. So they are basically, and these groups, ISIS, for example, is not just one group of people from one country. They're from all over the place, including European countries. The Islamists from European countries come in, and they travel through Turkey. One of them, actually, one of the jihadists was interviewed by a newspaper, and he says that they got health checkups to make sure they're healthy enough. They got health checkups in Ankara, which is the capital city of Turkey. So they got their health check. It's a whole setup. So they're moved from Chechnya. Yeah, Chechnya. They're moved from Tunisia. They're moved from all over GCC countries. Come in, and even some of the fighters that fought in Libya now with their weapons, they're moved into Turkey and Jordan in those camps, get their health checkups, and they're trained there. So who trains them? So now we found that the funding is done by GCC, right? But who are the trainers? Trainers are NATO, basically, whoever, you know, more NATO countries. CIA trains them. And this, of course, this information is also was published in the U.S. Newspapers, news media, not widely, not on the mainstream, but you can read that. Again, I have all the links in my article. So the CIA M16, which is the CIA of British, and I could not find a lot of connection with Mossad. So Mossad is usually involved in it too, but I couldn't find a lot of information on that. But of course, also the MIT, MIT, which is the Turkish intelligence, all together, they train them in these camps. And the jihadist explains in his interview how they're trained on what. I have the video. You can watch it. And after that, of course, when they're ready, it usually takes about a month, he said, for training, 45 days, a month. And then they are moved into, transported into Syria and from Syria to Iraq now. So what are the objectives of these people, right? So why would U.S. be using these people? Well, there are, of course, we know with Saudis and U.S., the geopolitical domination, that's the first thing. We want our control there. And who supports in Syria Assad is supported by Iran and behind the scenes by Russia, right? Mm-hmm. So this is, again, more of a control against Hezbollah, the Shiite organization that's backed by Iran, and they undermine Iran's and its ally Syria's. And they're behind-the-scenes supporters, Russia and China's influence in the region. So this is the first objective is the geopolitical domination. Second objective is to control the oil routes and the gas routes, the natural resources, you know, where they come from. It is so interesting that actually when you look at the map where the ISIS holds the territory now in Iraq and Syria, it's all overlapping oil fields. So that just tells you what their actual aim is. And the other, the third objective that I think is a possibility also about the U.S.'s conquer, divide, and rule plan, which is a strategic plan that is, you can, you know, read online about it. It's a again, about geopolitical domination, similar to what happened in former Yugoslavia, and they're trying to implement it in Ukraine, basically to take a strategic country with a lot of natural resources and also geopolitically located somewhere important, and divide it into little pieces in order to rule it. It's easier to rule smaller countries. So this was after the invasion of Iraq in 2007. There was a measure introduced by then Senator Joseph Biden and the Sam Brownback, two senators. It's called three-state solution. And the measure was, you know, it had a bipartisan support in Washington. It passed. But the Iraqi politicians in Baghdad, they were not happy with it. So they denounced it, and they said it's, you know, United States meddling our sovereignty. But the analysts that called it a part of the plan of the divide and rule is, I believe, it's the third objective. It's what's going on there. So my instincts, my journalistic instincts are telling me that the country will end up separating in three or four regions. The Kurdish, where most of the oil is. I don't know where ISIS, this group is going to go, but the Sunnis and Shiites probably will want their own part. So these are the objectives, and this is the way it works, from GCC funding to NATO training, and then these groups are used for, you know, regional objectives, regional aim. And they're really, I often think the members of the group, the actual fighters, the jihadists in the groups, they don't know. They really think they're fighting for their Islamic jihad.
Right, right.
You know, they really think they're fighting for their religion. But the leaders who, you know, organize, get these groups together, they are the ones, they know who they're working with. You know, they're the ones getting the money. They're the ones getting the weapons and training. So they understand the leaders. They know who they work for. So this is basically what's going on right now.
You know, the thing that, I mean, there's so much irony there and double dealing. You know, we hear so much from the right wing here in America about the real problems and what's at issue here. And you know, the one consistent message besides, you know, just go bomb them and blow them up and all that stuff is that, you know, this is the war they've been warning us of. This is the battle for the Grand Caliphate, you know, from India to the Mediterranean, and Europe's going to be in play. And the thing that I find so pathetically ironic is that if there's one group that's done more to unite the Middle East, it's this stupid, you know, constant, please, let's get them all fighting each other. Well, you know, by the time you've got Saudis fighting in Syria and Iranians fighting in Iraq, and you've got, I mean, it's just, you know, who's funding it? Who's arming them? Well, it's us, the West, for God's sake. So here we are. We're the ones organizing the attack of the Grand Caliphate. It's more our energy than anybody else's. What madness this is.
Correct. Well, I mean, you definitely need to follow the money, and you need to also think who are making the most money out of these conflicts. You know, who made the most money in Iraq? What happened? Cheney's company Halliburton made $39 billion. Defense contractors, weapon traders. So these people enjoy war. I mean, they make money. You know, United States, one-third of United States economy depends on armed conflict around the world. So it's only logical to think that we would like to start more, right? When you think about it that way.
Yeah.
So you need to also, like I always say, follow the money. The setup is pretty good. You can control and the chaos. They are thinking they will be able to control. It's like a controlled chaos. Like they think they can control these groups.
Right.
My concern has always been, just like what happened in Afghanistan when Reagan decided to support Mujahideen against the Russians, you know, Soviets, and arm them, train them. It's a very similar situation. How do we trust these people? I mean, who is using who?
Exactly.
Maybe we are using them for our objectives and our plans in the region, but who's to say they're not going to turn on us one day? So it's kind of like I wrote one of my friends on a discussion on Facebook. It's kind of like sleeping with your enemy.
Sure.
And I think maybe United States trusts its military power, thinking if they turn on us, we can always, you know, go back and annihilate them, I guess. But it's very dangerous. A lot of innocent people are dying on the way, and including our own troops, our own soldiers, over, you know, close to 8,000 of them between Afghanistan and Iraq died, lost their lives, and how many of them injured. And we know the situation in VA. They're not even well taken care of right now. I mean, it's a disaster. You can look at this, and we need to understand that the armed conflicts, who makes money in it, who starts it, and we need to really start saying enough is enough, and this has to stop. We need to understand the root causes of it, who is supporting it, and be more open to new information. We can't just accept the official narrative anymore. We just can't, because most often than not, it's not correct.
Let me ask you this. You know, from your contacts back in Turkey, I know that, if you will, there's always a, you know, a formal official narrative. This is what's really going on. And, you know, always the intelligentsia, because there's intelligent people everywhere that can see past the veil of lies. What are you hearing from friends in Turkey about this whole situation? I mean, you know, let's say that the Kurds are going to get more power because they're going to be in charge of Mosul.
Yes.
That can't be sitting well with the powers in Turkey who've been effectively keeping the Kurds at bay for a long time. You know, what are you hearing over in Turkey? What's Turkey's perspective on this Syrian-Iraqi situation?
Well, the AKP government, the Erdogan's government, current government that's ruling the Turkey right now, they are the one, of course, supported them. And because, you know, they are really Islamist, so they supported these groups, their training, and plus the funding on top of it. In Turkey, as I explained before, the camps in Turkey, that couldn't happen without the knowledge of the government, of course,
sure.
and the intelligence, MIT, Turkish intelligence. So for now, the news media that supports the government, basically at the hands of government, which is extremely censored anyway, they seem like they're trying to calm the situation, not make it a big deal, and because they know they supported them. And maybe they actually know the actual reasons behind it and the plan. But as always, like you said, there are smart people. They're asking more questions. The journalists are asking more questions, are discovering that they probably have the same concerns that I have. Are these people going to turn on us, and what's going to happen? And they do understand the three-state solution that was talked when the United States first invaded Iraq.
Sure.
Actually,
sure.
There was a suspicion in Turkey that was the original, that was the reason for it, and then the United States are going to separate the country into three or four regions, and then the oil areas where the, you know, Mosul and Kirkuk is going to be under Kurdish control. The interesting thing is, Kurdish autonomous region, the government there, had signed a lot of oil contracts with the Turkish government, despite the central Iraqi government, against the central Iraqi government's wishes. Al-Maliki, right now the president of Iraq, he was very against that idea. But Turkish government didn't listen, al-Maliki, and they signed, because they need oil too, of course. So they signed a lot of oil contracts with the Kurdish government up north. So this is what I hear, that a lot of people, journalists and people that have been doing the research on this topic, think that the country is going to be separated. But the nationalist group, there are, of course, in every country, Turks also have a large group of nationalists. They think Turkey should get involved and take over northern part of Iraq because of the older you know, treaties that's going all the way to First World War. After First World War, what the treaties that were signed between Turkey and Iraq and the regions, after the League of Nations, you know, draw the borders there.
Right.
So some people think the Mosul and Kirk, at that area where the oil, mostly oil is, belongs to Turkey. So they are actually urging, these nationalistic groups are urging Turkish government to get involved, send the army, send the military. So I don't know where it's going to go, but government has been really quiet, and there's going to be an election of, selection, I should say, of the prime minister, the president in Turkey, because Turkey has the presidency and prime minister. It's a little bit different than the United States, mm-hmm. more like British next year. So they're kind of focusing on that, trying to change the headlines. They're focusing on that right now, they're offering new candidates for prime presidency. So there was more focus on that, the candidates' presidency, than what happened in Assad, but in Iraq. But nationalistic groups also are worried that in some of those little cities, there are a lot of Turkmen. They're, you know, Turkish race, Turks, mm-hmm. actually. But they do speak Arabic, but they've been there since the Ottoman Empire. And I think these jihadists were killing a lot of them. So they were a little bit worried about that. They were telling that the military needs to get involved to go, you know, save these people, just like what happened in Cyprus. You know, the minority Turks were getting butchered. So that is this push also for military to get involved in it. And we'll see where it's going to go.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your perspective. And I will put a link to your story up on our website, okay?
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, you're very welcome. And have a wonderful day, Emily. Bye-bye.
You too, Rick. Bye.
Hello, Gwen.
Hi, Rick. How are you tonight?
Very good. I want to welcome Ms. Gwen Holden-Berry. Producer, director, news person, progressive journalist, spiritual gal, a woman of great wisdom and depth. Welcome, Gwen.
Thank you. Thank you for all the titles.
Well, you know, when you invite a personage like yourself, you really need to, you know, set the pedestal in place. So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome with me Ms. Gwen Holden-Berry. Gwen, how you been?
I've been doing all right, in and out of physical ailments. It's that time of the year or the season of life, maybe, that I'm going clearing. You know, you're clearing. You're getting
sure.
ready for the third act. So I think
absolutely.
That's
happy
going
solstice
on.
To you.
A very happy solstice to you too. And now we're counting the days down, aren't we?
Evidently, that's the way the planets roll, I guess, you know, given the gravity hole and all.
Oh, but keeps up. I wanted to say that I was reading earlier today Emily's post about ISIS, and you can imagine how happy I am with that acronym. It's a very thorough, very detailed account of just exactly who they are and what they want and who is behind them. I really commend her article. It's terrific. Anybody who really wants to know what's going on there and some of the details, I've posted it. I think folks should give it a look over there at the Progressive Press.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, between the astrological weather and the froth on mainstream media, I don't know what to ask you first.
Well, I'll tell you what, you had said something about discussing the war, which is going on all over the place, and there's so many of them, and there's so many names given to them other than war. But, you know, the thing is, Rick, between every good diplomat knows, every good politician since before Pharisees and pharaohs, and every good soldier and warrior knows, war is a failure. It's a failure as it begins. And we keep failing. I'm talking about the whole human population. We keep failing. And I think the opportunity now is to look at war and say, this is a failure, and we need to change it. The more people who see it for what it really is, I mean, you get a guy like Dick Cheney who says a prayer for the oil fields publicly across the media stream. What is that?
Was
you
that,
know,
I thought that was a parody. You're serious. That was real?
Yeah. Guys, he's playing for the oil fields, dear.
I saw that, and I thought, some comedian's having a good shot. That was, oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Oh.
That's amazing. There's an ironic article up on Fire Dog Lake called War Profiteers Ecstatic at Mideast Mess. Unfortunately, it's terrible true.
It is terribly true. And, you know, things come around. You were talking about the astrological weather.
Right.
That grand cardinal cross will not be – we're going through a T-square right at this time for the next, I don't know, 2 or 3 days. But the influences of it aren't over until the end of next month. And you have to wonder what shifting and changing is going on. I can't help but think that there are catalysts going on, you know,
uh-huh.
at this. I look at how many back-speaking people there are, both sides in the spotlight.
Speaking of that, I got to tell you, I find it more and more difficult to watch the official news on Sunday mornings. I really struggle,
yeah.
and I really can't take in as much as I used to be able to. You know, I mean, I'm inoculated.
I got a cure for that. You remember those Nerf guns?
Yeah.
I use a Nerf gun.
Wait, hear this. On CNN today, on their Review the Press show, I had to pinch
mm-hmm.
myself 3 times. Do you know what I heard? I heard a journalist. Now, of course, he wasn't a mainstream journalist. He was an off the beaten path journalist. But I heard a journalist on CNN's air saying, oh, my God, we are inviting Cheney and Wolfowitz and Condoleezza to talk about war policy. What, are we crazy? Yet I even went back to Iran-Contra because we're seeing figures from Iran-Contra. These are convicted felons. What are they doing on the air? And I swear, Gwen, I'm pinching. I'm going, am I hearing that on mainstream media? CNN must truly be desperate to dangle in the truth for a minute.
Well, and last week also was it – what's her name? Kelly Ryan, is that her name over at Fox? She danced with Dick Cheney and brought it back to him that he was responsible for taking us into war with Iraq in the first place and being completely wrong about weapons of mass destruction and all. And she counted off all these different points, and I was like, what?
Oh, my God.
There were flying in my mouth. I was like, what? Are you kidding? So there's different catalysts at work here. And anytime you see the mother of the cosmos, her name used as an acronym for such antithesis, something's going on larger than we realize. It's more of a collective thing, I think, on a whole planetary level. It's time to wake up. It really is. They interviewed Hillary Clinton, The Guardian did, and asked her if she was a little unsure of her constituency and the voting public because she's one of the 1%, and she immediately said that, why should I be? We pay our taxes. And I thought, my God, if lies were flies, they'd be covered. Bill Clinton's, what do you call it, his organization, billions of dollars, no taxes paid, billions of dollars. Her, she's doing the same thing. This is the what do they call it? The Potomac two-step.
Yeah. I understand that Chelsea's only getting $6 million a year. I wonder how she makes ends meet.
Oh. It's become ridiculous. It's become ridiculous. And yet, if you step outside, you walk three blocks away from the White House. Children are starving. Three blocks away in Washington, D.C., the poverty level and the children that have been denied by the Catholic Church because of gay rights and such and all of these other issues that they use as their flags to fly, to say, no, I'm not going to give up nothing. These children are going without meals. That is a starvation. That's child abuse. And it's at the hands of the government and the people sitting in Congress. We really need to think and focus as aware and awake people more about our local politics, because if we do and we put the right people into our state legislatures and our local governments, look what certain states are doing. They're saying no to GMO. They're saying no to gun rights. They're beginning to enact their own gun regulation laws. States are taking the power and doing the right thing because the people are putting it together that way. In D.C., all you've got is lobbyists, corporatists, plutocracy, and 1%. Let them boil in their own fat, you know? It's disgusting.
I'll tell you, it's amazing.
And at that point, I mean, people should be listening to Progressive News Network. You are right on top of the local issues and the state issues.
Thank you.
Shame on me. I had to have Anita cue me in on the Sable. What does she call it? The Sable gas.
Right,
the Sable pipeline. And I'm like, holy crap, I've been too focused in on global and national issues, local issues, what we have to pay attention to. And I think that we all come to it when the elections are going on, but too late, too few, too little information. And I have to say, I'm not going to make that mistake again, and I'm going to reflect wise back to the people that I am friendly with locally and on my social networks. You know, social networks are what are ultimately waking people up right now more than anything else.
Well,
and,
you know, I think in a way it's an expansion of our interconnectivity. It's an expansion, literally, of our nervous system, because people are using that to reach out, and they're communicating, and they're forming new communities of intent. And just like, you know, when the right wing huddle among themselves and reinforce their own dreams and nightmares, you know, when good progressive people, when thoughtful, intelligent people get together, they share those intellectual resources. And, you know, good things are bound to happen. I wanted to draw your attention to a local issue that you may not have heard about. There's a wonderful event coming up this Tuesday called the South Florida Voices for Working Families. And it's an event following up on an event that's going to be Monday in the White House, where they're talking about working people and the needs of working people. And I think it's amazing and heartening that the White House has noticed that there's actually working people who are paying, you know, getting paid minimum wage. But they're doing this event in Miami on Tuesday. And I mentioned to Kit Rafferty, the executive director of South Florida Voices for Working Families, you know, she was talking about how this state is so gerrymandered, and consequently the Republicans who, you know, booked themselves permanent seats there in the legislature, you know, they don't do much for the working people. And I said, well, you know, wait a minute, Kit. Wait a minute. There is something I can point out. I heard just last year the legislature passed a great big tax giveaway to people who own private planes. And I said, when you're hosting that event for the South Florida Voices for Working Families, maybe some of those people could take advantage of the huge tax break for their private planes. She said she'd be mentioning that right there between the NAAC speech and SEIU's discussion of how to stretch your food stamps a little further.
Jeez.
And she did mention that, that there will be many employees of Walmart there, which, as you know, is a corporation that in the U.S. Disemploys more people than anybody else.
Jeez. I saw where somebody was arguing on Facebook in one of our rooms where everybody goes to post political things. That, oh, no, Hillary Clinton was never involved with Walmart. And I said, I thought to myself, well, how the hell do you think Bill Clinton got into the governor's mansion? Jeez. The idea that people don't know, in fact, with the great South Florida event for working families, and how is it getting up? How did it get into D.C.? Do you know? How did it get to the president's attention?
I would guess a PR campaign on somebody's part, you know, to try to capture some of that economic disparity story that's been pounding around their ears for, you know, 6 years now. Maybe they've noticed. So I take great heart. I take great heart.
Yeah.
In the White House, sudden random acknowledgement of a major issue that's starving most of America right now. Other than that, you know.
Jeez. I was really, I was listening to the first part of your show, too, about the pesticides. And I was having an argument with a neighbor here, a good friend, is saying, oh, you know, you can't get away from it. It's there. And when she said today about the strawberries and then about the umbilical cords.
Yep.
And all of that, it was like, whoa, buddy. Boy, do we need permaculture.
Yeah.
We need permaculture bad.
You know, I have to tell you a little story I heard. The pesticide thing just rang so big in my ears. I typically don't get into internet arguments. I just think they're mostly non-productive, and there's no sense talking to somebody who has a closed mind. But an individual attacked a friend of mine online, and I felt, you know, worthy of a response. And he made the argument, and you're going to laugh because you're a woman who knows the sea quite well. He said, you know, all you environmentalist lefties, you're always decrying the terrible damage done to the Gulf and to our waters. He said, you know, I had friends that were fishermen, and they were fishing in the Gulf right during the BP thing, and they think everything is fine. They said the water was clear. And I said, well, when you use the analytical agency of the human eye, the chances of it including mass spectral information about the petroleum pollutants in the water or the Corexit or you know, just the bulk oil sitting there, no, you're not going to see that. But I said the point of science, you see, is that, you know, you get the facts as opposed to what the eye observes. I said you may have heard of germ theory or viruses. These are also the products of progressive leftist scientists. So I would be careful using those things. He came back with...
What did he come back with?
He said, well, you know, and besides, he said, you know, I've been eating fish all my life. And I said, luckily, you'll never notice the mental deterioration from the mercury you've been ingesting.
Jeez. You know, they went out today. The dolphin are running off our coast here. Big, beautiful, good-looking dolphin, bull dolphins. Remember?
Uh-huh.
And by dolphin, I mean, I should be clear, not porpoises. These are the mahi-mahi fish.
Yeah.
And they're running. They're big. They're fruitful. They're going, you know, the flying fish are coming up before them. It's big. And my neighbor brought home several pounds. And he went to fillet them, and it wasn't a good thing. The meat was not the way it should have been.
I declined my, you know, my fillets.
Yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't firm like it should be. It was hard for a new fillet knife to go through them, you know,
and
without
God.
Falling apart. That's scary. So, you know, and the other thing is, too, a lot of folks are under the impression that it's, you know, the trees and plants that produce all our oxygen, and it's really the oceans, it's bathos. The algae blooms that come up, you know, that that's where our oxygen comes from, a majority of it. And that's what's being corroded at the level of way down deep. And folks don't get that, especially about the Gulf. But the Gulf folks do, most of them.
I picked up a news story from the Herald today saying that a study finds that oil from the BP spill impedes fish swimming. A new study has found that oil from the 2010 BP spill is impairing the swimming in one of the ocean's fastest fish, mahi-mahi. Now,
yep.
Speed is not just a function of muscles, it's a function of nerves and nervous systems and brains. I think probably
right.
What we're looking at is neurological damage is what it sounds like to me.
Yeah. And, you know, when as the person I am, as the spiritual woman I am, and reaching out to my fellow creatures, thinking about those fish having to swim that way, the energy that creates in the sea for all the other creatures, everything's out of whack, Rick.
I got a story out of Colorado that says 7,500 gallons of oil spilt in the Colorado River, a storage tank damaged by floodwaters, dumped 7,500 gallons of crude oil in the Powder River near Windsor in northern Colorado, slickening vegetation a quarter mile downstream. But, now here's the kicker, but apparently not affecting any drinking water, state officials said.
Are they crazy? Crazy?
If I was to give them the benefit of the doubt, I would say inattentive. Because you know government scientists as I do, and when they don't want to know something, they aggressively don't study it. Because if you don't have the data, then we can't say we know something.
That's like the White House aggressively ignoring XL pipeline.
Yes, we're not deciding. We're not deciding. That's the same thing that the Palestinians hear from the Jewish leadership in that country over there. We're studying.
I don't know anybody who has a brain or who is aware. I don't know anybody who is not calling Israel an apartheid state, including myself.
It's terrible.
It's an apartheid state. It has become that, and the terrible part about it is that more people, it used to be many people, many Jewish citizens did not feel that way, but more and more their right side over there, they're conservatives, they're Hasidic, the folks that are living in the and taking out of the Gaza Strip area and everything are getting more and more political and media attention, and they're drumming it into the rest of the citizenry. Not all of them, but a lot of people are beginning to think, well, we have every right to do that, and la, la, la. And it's like, are you kidding me?
Well, they have a similar feeling in the Sunni region of Iraq. And, you know, I mean, this territorial... we'll kill anything that disagrees mentality is really lamentable. And you know, I wonder sometimes,
yeah.
You know, we've clearly got a part of the population is really focused on building a better world and making a better future.
Yeah.
And we've got some
yeah.
who seem to be perfectly happy doing things the old way. I heard an interview and a survey on NPR, which is, you know, as questionable a resource as any other. But they said that they interviewed a group of people, and that most people they interviewed said that they thought the war was perfectly normal. Nothing wrong with that. We've been doing it a long time. We'll never stop that. Oh, my God, not war. Oh, we got to have war. And I just thought,
what,
my God.
Yeah. Well, like I said when I first came on with you tonight, I mean, war is a failure. And the ignorance of that fact from any kind of media reporting, I mean, it's all about, you know, it's like John McCain, who came through here when he was campaigning for the presidency against Bush, who Murphy and I talked to, who I didn't agree with on a lot of things, but I liked. I liked him. He was a nice, I drank beer, you know? He wasn't what he became after Bush got through, Rove, I should say. Karl Rove got through with him. And here's the guy who walks up on a stage and says, you know, to get elected, you know, bomb, 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 bomb Iran. That kind of mentality is a failure. In fact, the leadership of our country is a failure. They're all failures, you know. I'm not saying I'd be.
Let's see if we can do this.
A winner.
How many countries can we name that we're at war in? Let me start off with some of the harder ones, and you can fill in any way you want. So I can imagine we got troops over in Niger, right? We got troops in Nigeria. We got troops across the Sahara. Probably too many countries to name there. Libya and Tunisia. And Egypt, of course, we've probably got advisors there. And then we've got, you know, our troops supporting, Syria, probably Lebanon, of course, Iraq, Afghanistan. We've probably got secret people over in Iran. We've got them over in Palestine, Pakistan,
You know, the funny part about that, Rick, is you're mentioning the whole Lebanon there. And yet one state that we're not in. What state is that?
Oh, you mean our allies over there?
Yeah, it's allies.
Ones that think that women are only necessary for breeding and that's about it?
No, I'm thinking about Israel myself.
Oh.
But what were you thinking of?
I was thinking of Saudi Arabia, but,
you
know.
But we do have troops. We do have troops in Arabia. We do have a small military. Like we still have a presence in Colombia, and several different South American countries. One place we don't have a presence
for hot wars.
Is Mexico.
I was just going for hot wars rather than cultural wars.
Oh my gosh, and yet. You know, the real sad fact is we bring all these young people into service. They go over, they come back, and now we're in all kinds of corruption and mismanagement about their care and rehabilitation from the failure of war. And 22 of these veterans a day are taking their own lives because they can't cope with the world.
You know,
this
it just
is,
seems to me
bad.
That it's so among the many and multiferous sins of the militant right. You'd think that at least take care of all the soldiers that they created and all the wounded that they created. You know, isn't there a minimum amount of humanity they can attain to? I mean, obviously we've heard them, you know, jeer at somebody who was dying of cancer and in their little pep club. But my goodness. Well, Gwen.
Yeah.
You are a woman of such depth and wisdom. Give us a thought for our evening, my dear. Can I trouble you for that, or a blessing as you choose?
Absolutely. The one thing we have to hold and walk with and never veer away from is just kindness. We got to stay kind. You
absolutely.
Know, you can get upset, but be kind. Be as kind as you can, especially to yourself.
And on that beautiful, beautiful note, I want to say good night. Thank you so much, my friend.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you, buddy, for having me on.
Okay, good night. And ladies and gentlemen, I want to remind you there are so many other good progressive advocates on the air. Susan Nylon, the Nylon Report, Gwen Holden Berry and her Here Be Monsters, Sita McGuill and McGuill Media, Anita Stewart and her wonderful show, Wise Women. And so many others. Thank you all so much for tuning in. Hope to talk to you again soon. Next week, it's an art show. So I hope you join us. We're going to have a little bit of fun.
And now...
maybe we're not the only dreamers, huh?
Yeah. Good night, friends.